playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Would you know what to do with €175 million? On Wednesday, we woke to news of the biggest EuroMillions jackpot win ever on this island. And in the national interest, Sean O'Rourke, well known for his forensic interviewing skills, set about finding out the winner's identity. But there was no cracking Miriam Donoghue, spokesperson for the National Lottery.
Sean, listen, I can reveal just in the last few minutes we've had contact from the EuroMillions ticket holder. So
yeah, there's a lot of speculation. I mean, for instance, Thomas Byrne, the Fianna Fáil TD, has been tweeting congratulations. He believes he knows the people. It's somewhere, well, places like Duleague are mentioned, Donal in North County Dublin, Bellew's town there in County Loud. Can you enlighten us further?
I've heard Donegal, I've heard Tullamore, I've heard Waterford. Sean, there's a lot of speculation, and honestly, at this point in the day, I'm not in a position to give any indication as to where that ticket was sold. But if we do have news before the close of your show this morning, I'll certainly be happy to get back in touch.
Well, that's very good of you. So it's all systems go. Is it an individual who's won it, or is there a syndicate?
Again, I'm not in a position to say it at this point in time, Sean. All we know is that there is somebody who called us with a ticket that appears to be the winning ticket. And look, we've given some very quick advice on the telephone to that person, just, you know, part of the claims process to be sure to get very good, sound legal and financial advice. And what's probably not known is the monies from the 9 participating EuroMillions countries, that monies won't be fully transferred to our account until probably the mid of next week. So the winner wouldn't be in a position to come here and take away a cheque today anyway.
How long would it take them to make the journey?
To make the journey
from
to
where
the
they
office.
Are, yeah.
Sean, it depends if you're walking, cycling on a train.
Well, if you know,
if I'm not going to. I'm not going to.
Okay, right. Well, you can understand if I try. Well, look, Miriam Donoghue, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, and we'd take a phone call ourselves, I suppose, if the. And just one thing before you go. I mean, do you know what the person was like on the phone? Were they able to contain their excitement? Had they slept last night?
The person was very calm, surprisingly calm, and seems to be very together. That's really.
Can you say, was it male, female, young or old?
I can't say, Sean, at this stage. But top marks for trying.
Sure, we all love a trier. Of course, the rumour mill went into overdrive, and it being Ireland, it wasn't long before all roads led to Riley's Daybreak store in the Knoll, a small village in North County Dublin, 500 feet from the Meath border. Les Riley sold the golden ticket, and he spoke with Ray Darcy.
€175 million. I hope there's a lot of people involved in it. Wish them the very best of luck with it.
Yeah.
Most of all, happiness, health, and spread the love.
I heard you on the news of one, and you were saying you don't know if you get money. I can tell you, you get €25,000 for selling
really?
That ticket. Yeah.
Happy days.
Did you not know that?
I didn't actually know. You know, I've talked to that many people today. I still haven't talked to the guys from the last lot.
Have you not? I'm delighted to bring you that good news. That's nice and a bit of news, isn't it? You'll go up there.
That's great. But anything to see the happiness of the village, Ray, is a bonus. It's a little village and very, very big heart in the community. And it's like one big family.
Well, as you can imagine, there was massive media interest. RTÉ's northeast correspondent Sinead Hussey was in the thick of it, soaking up the buzzy atmosphere.
It's a small village in North County Dublin, a population of just over 500 people. And from what I could gather yesterday, it's like most villages across Ireland. Everyone knows everyone. It's a very tight-knit community. It's recently been hit with 2 tragic deaths. So understandably, this win has given the whole place a huge lift. And nearby then in Duleek and Bellew's town, where some of the members of the family are living, there was excitement there too. The local GAA club has a slogan, small village, big dreams. And as locals are saying yesterday, that certainly rang through.
So what do we know so far about the family who've won this?
Well, we know they're a local family. They're originally from the Knoll, but some are living in Duleek and Bellew's town. They're a syndicate of brothers and sisters. Some are retired. They have a large family, I'm told, children and grandchildren. They play the lotto regularly, and they learned of the news when one of the family spotted the numbers on the RTÉ 9 o'clock news on Tuesday night. So she kept the ticket in an Argos catalogue and she put it under her mattress. So you can imagine she didn't get much sleep, but they issued a statement yesterday through Lotto headquarters, and they said that the news was still sinking in. They don't want this win to dramatically change their lives, but they said what is exciting is that they'll be able to share this money with their children, their grandchildren and their extended family. And amazingly, it's actually the second time that fortune has hit this family. The husband of one of the women who's in the syndicate actually won £600,000 years ago in the National Lottery.
And there's reports in the papers today that it's a group of 9 brothers and sisters. What have the locals been saying about the family?
Well, look, anyone I asked yesterday, Samantha, had the exact same thing to say about this family. Decent, hardworking people. Couldn't have happened to nicer people. Everyone delighted for them. They have a big family, so no doubt this money will go a long way.
Sinead Hussey with Samantha Librari. So everyone's delighted in the Nile, and it's a mega windfall for the Lucky Syndicate. Physicist Shane Bergen was weighing up the chances of winning the EuroMillions jackpot when he spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
It's incredible. The likelihood of you winning the EuroMillions, it's 1 in 140 million, the chances of you winning the EuroMillions. Now, that's exceptionally small. In science or maths terms, we'd say effectively that's zero. Now, I know for that one person or persons out in Nol this morning, it means the world to them. But we do spend a lot of money, about 800 million a year we spend on the lotto in Ireland, which is a lot of money.
Like, this is the second one on this island in the course of this year so far, and there have been previous ones.
Absolutely. I guess it's quite interesting from a psychological perspective to consider, why is it that we obsess about things that are incredibly unlikely, but yet we think very little about things that are quite likely? So, for instance, people get very nervous going on an aeroplane, and it's a 1 in 5 million chance of you having an accident on an aeroplane or there being a crash, which is effectively, it's little or nothing again, but the chances of having an accident crossing the road are significantly higher. I suppose it's that we do it frequently and we become used to it.
Shane Bergen heard on the Today Show on Wednesday. Well, as the celebrations continued in the Nile, news emerged that the drinking of pints at parties hosted by Dublin's Lord Mayor Neil Ring in the Mansion House had reached Olympian levels, and the annual allowance of the black stuff donated by Guinness had run out in just 6 months.
Mayor, you must be having some great parties there in the Mansion House.
Well, Sean, the figures don't lie. I've had 8,000 people in for evening events in the Mansion House, an average of 1,000 a month. Now, they come in and they might have a bit of finger food or they might have a pint. Now, if I've gone through 10,500 pints and I've had 8,000 people, well, you can divide it. No one's fallen out of the Mansion House down the steps into Dawson Street in front of the Lewis and been knocked down by trams, Sean. So, I mean,
I'm just looking at the figures. I mean, you're in office since late June of last year, right? And yeah. As of last week, you had served, according to the Dublin Inquirer, 194, right? Now, that's equating to 17,000 pints. By comparison, during the same period, the previous mayor, Sinn Féin councillor Micheál McDonagh, used 54 kegs, and his predecessor, Brendan Carr, Labour councillor, used just 31 barrels in his first 6 months. So you're about 4 times as generous as the others.
Well, 34 barrels, Sean, is what, 3,000 pints? And to use that in a full year is...
First 6 months.
Oh, the first 6 months. Okay. Divided by 26, it's 100 pints a week. But, like, I have a function tonight and there's going to be 100 people at it. Sure, you go through 100 pints tonight, maybe 200 pints tonight.
Yeah. You know,
now, I'm not saying my predecessors hadn't as many people in, but I'm certainly... I have a function there more or less every night, and that's what the Mansion House... It's not the Lord Mayor's residence, it's the people's house.
Dublin's Lord Mayor Neil Ring. Well, Drive Time's John Cook has been reporting all this week on the recent amendments to motoring laws, including tougher penalties on drink driving. The new rules introduced by Transport Minister Shane Ross have led to fiery debates among rural TDs in Leinster House and a lot of annoyance among people living in isolated country parishes about what some are calling the morning after effect. This is where extra Garda checkpoints are set up and people are breathalysed on their way to Sunday Mass. John joined Sergeant Ronan Mahon of the Galway Roads Policing Unit on the Coast Road in Oranmore, where a woman in her 60s was breathalysed at the roadside.
Are you surprised to see a checkpoint on a Sunday morning?
I suppose it depends where I am.
Have you seen them before?
I have.
Have you been breathalysed before?
I have.
So you don't mind?
I don't, no.
Okay.
What I need you to do is form a seal around the mouthpiece with your lips and blow steadily and continuously until I tell you to stop, okay? And the demand is under Section 10 of the 2010 Road Traffic Act, as amended. Just take a deep breath and keep going until I say stop. That's it. Keep going, keep going, keep going. Perfect. It's just analysing there. Okay. That resulted in a fail, okay?
Yeah.
So what we'll have to do is get you to turn off the car, okay?
Okay.
And you'll be... brought into Galway Garda Station, you'll be arrested under Section 4A of the Road Traffic Act, okay? And we'll process you in the station, okay?
And
you're not obliged to say it unless you wish to do so, but you do say it, be taken down right, and I maybe give it an evidence, okay?
Margaret was clearly very shocked when the word fail appeared on the breathalyser machine, especially as drivers found even slightly over the legal alcohol limit now face 3 months off the road and a €200 fine.
I was totally in shock. I was really, really surprised. But I was suddenly aware, of course, that I had some wine last night.
You were drinking yesterday, so what was the situation, if you don't mind telling me?
I was at a christening in the afternoon, and I had wine at the christening. Not much now, but then when I came home later in the evening, I had another glass.
You just have maybe one glass of wine before bed, was it?
That's it. I had one before bed. I did.
And would you have got a good night's sleep, would you say? Because that's what a lot of people wonder about now, about alcohol and how it works its way through your system.
No, I had a very good sleep and felt fine this morning, had my breakfast and then decided I was going for a walk.
So you were driving out to the coast, was it?
I was driving out to the coast road, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going for a walk, but I really did feel fine, and I was aware, I know what I drank yesterday, and that was over the afternoon. So I'd say in the afternoon would have been a total maybe of two glasses of wine, mm-hmm. which I would feel like was like a half bottle.
And what would that mean to you to lose your licence for 3 months?
Well, it would be catastrophic because my car, I really need my car. I'm still doing some work all over, you know, in different parts of the country. Just even to get from A to B, I would be really lost because I like to be independent and it's usually the car I take.
As it turned out, after further tests at the Garda station in Galway City, Margaret was given the all clear. So all's well that ends well. John Cook reporting for Drive Time with Mary Wilson. Over on the live line, Joe's listeners were reacting to the controversial, hard-hitting Road Safety Authority television ad on the Clancy Amendment. The amendment, you remember, was introduced following the case of Geraldine Clancy and her daughter Louise, who were killed in a car crash involving an unaccompanied learner driver nearly 4 years ago. Anne Costello rang Joe. She was supportive of the RSA ad campaign.
I lost my son 22 years ago, and if those laws had been implemented, now they're not as drastic as they are now, but if these laws had been implemented 22 years ago, I would not have given the keys of the car to my son and let him off on his own. And he was killed. He was on a very narrow road, driving along, speeding. He was just 18, he was speeding, and he met an earth mover and hit into the wheel of an earth mover and went through the windscreen of the car. He died instantly.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I'll tell you now, Joe, I am racked with grief and racked with guilt ever since that I did that day, and that I didn't say to him, I can't go with you now, so you can't have the car, or else I'll go with you, you know. And he was on his own, and within half an hour he was dead.
And had he been driving long at that stage?
No, he wasn't driving long. He was only 3 or 4 months driving, and it was all down to inexperience. You can't give experience to young people. It is not something you can hand to them and say, there's your experience. They have to be helped and they have to be guided along on how to drive along the roads, you know. So,
And you're being brutally honest. But
I am absolutely. I absolutely admire the laws that have been brought in. And they're not strict enough as far as I'm concerned.
Had he been driving unaccompanied before that fatality?
He had, you see, it was easy for me to let him off. I thought he'd be okay. He was only 18. He had no sense. He never thought in a million years that he was going to meet an earth mover. An earth mover with massive, massive big wheels. You know,
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Monday. It's a year since Cork woman Samantha Barry was appointed editor-in-chief of Glamour magazine, one of the major titles in the fashion publication world. She joined Áine Kerr on the business live from New York City Fashion Week to talk money and strategy.
What about your own approach to negotiating your salary, knowing your value? Like, do you consider yourself good with money?
Look, I was very frank in my editor's letter. I've definitely had times where I've lived paycheck to paycheck, in particular in my 20s. I've become much more wise in my 30s. And one of the stories that we had in May was around the Salary Whisperer Network. And I tell the story very openly, and I'm happy to tell you as well, Áine. When I moved over from the BBC to CNN, that was my first job in the US. And I, you know, kind of took the first offer I was given. But when I was going to negotiate my contract, I did what I needed to do, which was get individually a couple of probably about four or five white guys drunk and ask them what they were making at, that were at the VP or thereabouts level, because I wanted the knowledge of when I was going in to negotiate, what should I be aiming for? And we had a lot of discussions internally about this. And it doesn't mean that you need to tell everybody you work with what you earn, but I do think you need to have a trusted group of friends in the industry that you're in and understand, are you being paid what you're worth? And I think that's important. I've become known as the person that you come to if you need to negotiate for your salary, because I think, first of all, salary is not the only thing that you need to negotiate for. Is it extra education? Is it a different title? It's really talking through the process. And I know a lot of men and women that are very confident in every other aspect of their life, professionally and personally. And then when it comes to sitting across from a boss and asking for more, they just fall apart.
I can imagine a lot of people come to you as a mentor for wise counsel like that. But what about as a manager, where you are managing folks day to day? What kind of a manager do you think you are in a large newsroom like that of Glamour's?
Yeah, I've managed a lot of young millennials and it's different. And I think when I talk to my peers, it's kind of a ongoing challenge, is the expectation of some, not all young people, of like every 6 months, I'm going to get a title change and more money. And that when the expectation is set on time and not effort, it's a little disappointing. I think I'm a very open manager, if I'm being honest, but I'm also a straight talker. Like, I'm not going to pretend somebody's doing a good job when they're not.
Samantha Barry, editor-in-chief of Glamour magazine. Well, on Tuesday, fashion designer Karl Lagerfeld died in Paris. He was 85 and had been working up to a few weeks before he got sick, heading up the House of Chanel. Stylist Cathy O'Connor recalled his work with Áine Lawler on the News at One.
He was a real rare breed because I think he had an extraordinary combination of talents and strengths, in that he was creative, he was an extraordinary businessman, and also had the ability to innovate, which, you know, very often to have those combinations just makes him such a superstar as he was.
And let's talk about Chanel, of course. Everybody knows Chanel perfumes, the double C logo. 3 decades with Chanel. It's an awfully long time for any designer, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I suppose he would have been there at a time when it was kind of what he described as a sleeping beauty, you know, when the label was nothing like as strong as it was, because Coco Chanel had died over a decade beforehand. And I suppose it was his ability, as I mentioned, to innovate that really kind of struck out, in the sense that he would have had kind of new ways of reworking with tweed, mixing it up with new fabrics and textiles like neoprene, like latex and like leather. And so he had always got that talent for being really true to the traditional signature of any of these houses and yet giving it a very fresh and updated look. When he was at Fendi's, at that time really renowned for their furs and bags, he was able to mix furs, make it more fashion furs, add colour, at a time when the ultimate status symbol for a woman at that time was to own a fur coat. So there was nothing fun about it, you know, so he had this ability to really mix it up and yet remain very loyal to the signature of a house.
A lot of controversy about his use of fur, and he wasn't afraid of controversy.
No, indeed not. I think, you know, reading about him, he was just a man who was very comfortable in his own skin and well able. He said that the great thing about kind of, you know, unpleasant people is that you can be more unpleasant back to them. So I think he had very strong opinions. He was very true to his own character in that way. And I think he had the luxury of being really marvellous at sketching pieces that had all of the technical designs, so that he would be able to give them to craftspeople whose work he really appreciated. So he was able to work in a far more alone kind of way than perhaps other houses might be able to do.
And he certainly gave his cat a beautiful name. His cat apparently has a huge Twitter following, Chopette.
Chopette, exactly. Yes, and I think they say that he wasn't in a kind of, one never knows, but a kind of relationship with anyone in particular for quite some time, but absolutely adored his cat. And I think, you know, that was one of his most devoted relationships that he had. But one of the things I was reading about him, a quote from him was that he said was, "What I enjoy most is doing something I've never done before." And I think that probably sums the man up quite well.
Stylist Cathy O'Connor with Áine Lawler remembering fashion legend Karl Lagerfeld, who died in Paris on Tuesday.
Thank you.
Moxie there with D-Rock's Polka, and they played live on the Ray Darcy show yesterday. An undercover investigation by journalists at the Times Ireland, published last Monday, has revealed that the American anti-abortion group Sidewalk Advocates for Life has set its sights on this country and is planning to bring its campaign tactics to doctor surgeries, hospitals, car parks to target pregnant women before they access abortion services. Ellen Coyne explained their strategy to Cullum Mungon.
So Sidewalk Advocates for Life is quite a large American anti-abortion group. It's never been active in Europe before, but has now moved to Ireland since abortion became illegal here. It told us that it plans to eventually have a presence outside every hospital and GP clinic providing abortion services in Ireland. What it does isn't protesting. It likes to directly intercept women when they're on the way in to access a termination, deter them and refer them to an anti-abortion crisis pregnancy agency, which, according to them, will hopefully eventually talk them out of terminating the pregnancy. It's also advised to was it's active in a lot of American states which have so-called exclusion zones, which are like the laws Simon Harris wants to bring in to ban protests and demonstrations outside hospitals and clinics. And it told our undercover reporter that it believed it had ways to get around those exclusion zones.
So does it have a network of people in Ireland, or are you talking about Americans travelling here? How are they going to staff this operation?
How they work is training local activists. So they've already trained some anti-abortion activists based in Dublin, and they told our undercover investigation that they wanted to expand across the country. Because we were undercover, we got access to some of the training that it offers to its anti-abortion activists. So today we're able to reveal some of the tactics that it uses. That includes targeting women who have become pregnant as a result of rape, telling them that the termination won't unrape them, telling them that the abortion itself can be like going through sexual violence again. And they also have a strategy of trying to target women who've experienced fatal fetal abnormality by trying to zone in on them in hospital car parks before they access a legal abortion.
And how do they appear? They wear high-vis vests. They look like they may be car park officials. Is that part of the idea behind this attire?
An active tactic is to wear high visibility vests to look official, to hopefully be mistaken for a parking attendant. We were also told to use colours like pink to attract women, to use so-called blessing bags filled with chocolate and lip gloss, expensive ones, to try and persuade women from low financial backgrounds that we'd be able to financially support them through their pregnancy, and using language, kind of feminist language, a very women-centred language, to appeal as friendly as possible to women walking into the clinic. These groups actively want to move away from, I suppose, traditional anti-abortion tactics of describing the woman as a murderer, of yelling abuse at her. The idea is to get as close to the woman as possible to talk her out of termination her pregnancy.
Times Ireland journalist Ellen Coyne with Cullum Mungon, as heard on Monday's Morning Ireland. Well, Health Minister Simon Harris was quick to respond.
So what we've seen today exposed by the Times Ireland is chilling, it's manipulative, and it's deeply disrespectful of our democratic process. We had a referendum in this country. The people of this country had their say and voted in overwhelming numbers to care for women here in our own country. And the idea that anybody, but particularly outside groups, would be trying to undermine our democratic decision and effectively, in my view, harass and intimidate Irish women is something that's quite despicable.
Well, over on the Today Show, the discussion centred on whether it was necessary to speed up legislation establishing exclusion zones around centres providing abortion services, or whether a strict ban would be an infringement on the right to peaceful protest. Cullum O'Gorman of Amnesty International Ireland campaigned on the Yes side during the referendum on the Eighth Amendment. Maria Steen campaigned on the No side.
A text from one of our listeners.
I
would find people standing with rosary beads staring at me silently very intimidating.
So would I.
And yet that's
what
they do.
Suggesting that's happening? Again, where is the evidence of this?
And
this
vigils
story,
outside a maternity hospital.
Oh, so you're
hospital.
Against prayer now, Colin,
are no,
you?
No, I'm not
you
against
are.
Prayer.
What
I'm
else are you against?
Maria, you just said that people are not standing outside
sorest
GP surgeries.
Ever. But
you said that people... Hang on a second now. You just said there's no evidence that people are standing outside health providers in the way that that listener just tweeted into Sean.
And a moment ago,
you said that prayer vigils are happening outside GP surgeries and hospitals.
No, I didn't say that. I said there was a vigil, a silent vigil outside.
Well, actually, the Iona Institute, or at least a staff member of the
Iona,
a staff member of the Iona Institute, who you're representing here today, was tweeting earlier that there are prayer vigils happening outside the National Maternity Hospital.
And do you have a problem with prayer?
You just said they aren't. Make your mind up. No, I don't have a problem with prayer. I fully respect people's right to pray.
And do you think they should be allowed to pray wherever they want?
You just said prayer vigils weren't happening.
Do you think people should be allowed to pray wherever they
want? And yet your organisation acknowledged on Twitter that prayer vigils are happening.
Do you think people should be allowed to pray wherever they want?
That's ridiculous. You need to cop on now. That's silly.
No, but it is. It is.
People are entitled to pray wherever they want to pray. Yes.
Okay.
Of course they are.
And outside hospitals?
But
they're not entitled to pray outside hospitals.
But people's right to exercise the right to freedom of religion, to freedom of expression, is not an unlimited right. It can't be used to trump people's right to privacy or right to access.
Who's invading anybody's privacy?
Or right to access healthcare. And you've
who's invading anybody's privacy by standing on the side of the street saying a silent prayer? Who's invading anybody's privacy?
Maria, first of all, you said it wasn't happening. Then you said it's not intimidating.
Does it not
reflect the complexity of trying to frame legislation? The idea, Maria Steen asked the question, how can you object to a group of people saying prayers outside, be it a hospital or wherever?
The intention of a protest or a vigil outside a healthcare provider that's providing abortion is clearly to try to prevent people from either access abortion or from abortion care being carried
out
on those premises.
Maybe their intent is just to pray?
That's the intention. And to suggest anything otherwise is risible and ridiculous. And Maria knows it, no matter how inflammatory she wants to get.
You think anybody who prays has some underhand motive? Is that it,
Colin? It's clear that that's the intent. Maria, I'm not going to constantly be pulled into agreeing with nonsense statements that you make that don't reflect what I said.
You're attacking pro-life people,
as usual. It's clear that that's...
People who disagree with you.
Okay.
Colm O'Gorman and Maria Steen, a debate that will run and run. Meanwhile, in Dáil-Éireann, Health Minister Simon Harris narrowly survived a Sinn Féin motion of no confidence by 5 votes. Oliver Callan and his crew cast a cold eye on Tuesday's debate.
Deputy Stephen Donnelly, Fianna Fáil, or whatever party he's in this week.
Minister Harris has proven himself incompetent, unable to manage the nurses, cervical check, the children's hospital, the department, or his budget. And that's why we in Fianna Fáil will completely support him.
Hello, Minister Donoghue.
Thank you, Count Carl. I think it's very important to say... I have confidence in Simon. I have confidence in rain. I have confidence that spring will come again. Besides which, you see, I have confidence in me.
He would have made a lovely nun, to be fair.
Hello, Deputy Random Healy Ray.
I know the nurses have confidence in you. No. Do the women have confidence in you? No. Do the dogs in the streets have confidence in you? No. Do the road and the
Deputy McGrath. A man's got to do what a man's got to do. But you're right in here, Minister, like Rambo entering the High Chaparral. And it's not what this is. Minister Harris, have you anything to say in your defence?
I think it's very important to Count Corlett that I let my tweets speak for themselves because I get frightened in front of large crowds and also facts.
Penis, I now call on the non-aligned deputies. You can share 30 seconds between you, Mick Wallace and Richard Boyd-Barrett. And to make it fair, I suggest you alternate words. Go.
Nobody
is
ever
held
accountable.
Time's up, right? Vote!
From Callan's kicks last night. Well, street law is a new voluntary course on offer to trainee Irish solicitors where they can teach practical law classes in schools and prisons. Evelyn O'Rourke went along to Mountjoy Prison to meet the trainee solicitors and prisoners taking part in the course, and Shane told her how he was enjoying the lessons.
Okay, which do you think is the most important right? You got to pick one, yeah.
Speech.
Why do you think it's important?
People need freedom to express their point of view and all. Like, yeah, man. If people need to be heard, they should be heard. Like, no matter what their opinion is, like whether they agree or don't agree, they're still having a right to an opinion.
Yeah, you know, exactly, and it's true.
Yeah, it's very important, yeah. Because growing up, like, secondary school, like, I didn't really learn a lot. So when I come in here, like, I'm doing me maths, going on to level 4 now, maths, like. And it makes you feel something inside, like, you know what I mean? A bit proud of myself, like, and achieve, like. I didn't think I could do any of this stuff until I came in here, like. And education helps that a lot, I think.
So tell me about a typical day for you, then.
Wake up 8 in the morning, out for breakfast, me breakfast, back
in. Are you on your own in a cell?
Yeah. Yeah, everyone has their own cell, yeah. No more doubles up or anything. Get breakfast, back in the cell then. From about 8:30, 9:30, doors open up again. About 10:30 then school will start.
And you do school from what, 10:30 to 12?
12 o'clock then, dinner time. And then banged out then till 2:15.
So you have the dinner in the middle of the day?
Yeah, it's bad. Back out onto landing, K kill an hour and a half up in the gym, then back down before, and then to tea time then. And then you bang back in your cell then till 4:15, 5:30, and then out till 7 o'clock.
And then what happens about 7:15 then?
Banged out, yeah. Everyone starts making their toasties under George Foreman and all then. And then big queue over it.
So what, you make your toastie and bring it back to your cell?
Yeah, you have to, yeah.
So you're back in your cell at what time?
7:15, yeah.
And then that's it till the morning?
Then that's it then, yeah. In for the whole night then.
Are you going to keep going with the education?
Yeah, till I get out, yeah.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for the Today Show from Mountjoy Prison. It's only 34 days to Brexit, and yesterday, Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney published the Omnibus Bill, which he described as a landmark piece of legislation, 15 laws in one, which will be needed to protect Irish citizens and businesses here if Britain crashes out of the EU without a deal.
A disorderly Brexit will be a lose, lose, lose for the UK, for the EU and for Ireland. We cannot offset all of the damage that it will do, but we are doing everything that we can through legislation, through preparation, through investment, through information, and through support of the multiple sectors and the multiple numbers of people that will be impacted potentially by that worst case scenario.
Taoiseach Simon Coveney. Well, the plan to mitigate the worst impact of a no-deal Brexit was also discussed on the News at One by RTE's economic correspondent Sean Whelan and Áine Lawler.
There's a huge amount in it, from student grants to taxes, pensions, travel, immigration, extradition, redundancy payments, healthcare. And the Dáil and Seanad will have to work hard to have it all passed by the end of the month. But the two biggies that stand out for you.
Well, the first biggie that stands out for me is just the pure intention behind this bill, which is to make a whole lot of legal changes to a whole lot of pieces of legislation in order that all the rest of us don't notice that there's been any change. And that's the kind of genius, if you like, at the heart of this bill. For all of us in our ordinary lives, whether we're getting a social welfare contribution, a pension from the UK, whether we're making investments in Britain and claiming tax relief on that, there's a whole range of things that we take for granted.
Insurance
products, premiums, the tax treatment of things, loads of plumbing and wiring type issues that we just take for granted that are going to be disrupted. The legal basis on which they rest will be disrupted because of Brexit. So what this bill does is makes one big fix to ensure that all of that legal disruption is put right and that there is no disruption. If this thing works as advertised, we won't notice it at all. And that is the really significant thing about this legislation. All the rest of it is essentially detail, and people who are interested in detail will be able to go through this in all kinds of, well, detail. But essentially, it shouldn't matter to most of us because if it does work as advertised, there won't be any changes. The only area that has an overt change in it that does have a significant impact is in the area of VAT. And that's because at the moment, people who are doing business with Britain, and we're talking more than 60,000 firms here, vast bulk of them SMEs, they currently do their VAT returns every 2 months. If Britain becomes a third country, or rather when Britain becomes a third country, under the existing law, they would be liable to pay VAT at the point of entry. As soon as their consignment arrives in the 26 counties, full VAT would be paid on the nail. That has enormous cash flow implications for firms. They were really panicking about this.
Mm-hmm.
The government have now changed that to treat Britain effectively as an EU country for the continuity of business purposes. And so they will continue to pay on an ordinary two-monthly basis. So again, we're back to this big idea. Nothing changes as a result of all these changes.
The Omnibus Bill was also discussed on The Gathering yesterday by political commentators Danny McConnell and David Davenpower.
Meanwhile, Danny McConnell, 35 days out, Brexit is coming at us like a train now.
Yes.
The Taoiseach are launching that bill. And also a pretty strong message as well for the external audience about there won't be any change in the backstop.
No, again, I think what you've had over the last while is a remarkable consistency in the messaging from both Simon Coveney and the European institutions. You know, we're in the kind of the 11th hour of the negotiations. You would have thought there may have been some crack in that display of solidarity, but it's been remarkably solid. Maybe it suits the European Union to, you know, to kind of use Ireland as a beat to stick the British with, so be it. What I haven't seen is any real workable solution that can bridge the gap between the EU position and the UK position that would satisfy or get us off the hook.
More so, needed. David, what grounds might Simon Coveney have for thinking that there won't be a no-deal Brexit?
Well, I think that it's looking slightly more optimistic. It's not a word you often hear in connection with Brexit. Given this fracturing of party support in Westminster this week, I think a no-deal Brexit is slightly less likely. But given the chaotic nature of politics in London at the moment, you can't really predict anything. I note that a group called the Brexit Delivery Group, would be middle-of-the-road Tories, have written to the chief whip suggesting that they will defy the party if they're asked to vote for a no-deal Brexit. So that, taken in conjunction with the defections, I think really means it's slightly less likely. We don't want to use this legislation that was unveiled today. That goes without saying. We don't want a no-deal Brexit. It would be chaotic. I mean, I just noticed a French official in a Lara Marlow interview in the Times today saying a no-deal Brexit means you have to control the frontier. He's talking about France, but that's equally as applicable on our own island.
Meanwhile, across the water, the Brexit chaos continues to play out in British politics.
Good evening and welcome to BBC News. More depressing than a wake at Wetherspoons. Your main headline, three Conservatives have joined eight Labour MPs in defecting to the newly formed Independent Group, a name so contradictory they might as well be called the Shaggable Frontbenchers. I'm joined on the line by Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn.
Thanks, Hugh.
What is your view on the loss of these eight MPs?
I'm appalled. I'm so angry I almost sound interested. These traitorous turncoats think they can sit on the sidelines, cribbing and moaning, ignoring the party line. That's my job. I should have them done for plagiarism.
But do you hold any personal responsibility for this?
Not at all. These backstabbing, spineless, smelly little tosspots are claiming they've been bullied out of Labour. Nonsense.
And what about their claims that you haven't done enough to combat anti-Semitism?
Rubbish. We did a serious and far-reaching inquiry / whitewash titled Ken Livingston's Funtime Dewey Jamboree. He even did the catering at the launch and his hummus was delicious.
So where now does this leave your party's policy on Brexit?
It's quite clear we are definitely... Sorry, I'm running out of credit. Beep, beep.
The Leader of the Opposition beep, there, pretending beep. To be dial tone. Now we cross live to number 10, where the Prime Minister is holding a press conference.
Prime Minister May, how do you respond to Anna Soubry's comments that the government was undergoing a shift to the right?
At this rate, the only shift I'll be doing is a night shift as a cash register at Asda.
Do these defections weaken your negotiating position with Brussels?
Not at all. You can't get any weaker than my current negotiating position. On my knees, cap in hand, saying, what if we give you Cornwall?
Prime Minister, surely losing these MPs leaves you more firmly in the grasp of the DUP.
I'll answer that question as soon as I've got back from filing down Arlene's bunions.
Prime Minister,
maximum humiliation reached. Shutting down.
There we leave it. Broken Brexit, broken Britain, broken newsreader. That's all from the BBC, where we didn't even have time to talk about the ISIS jihadi bride, Shamima Begum, now officially the second most hated bride in the British press after Meghan Markle. Good night.
Oliver Callan and his crew heard on Callan's Kicks last night. So how do we protect the border? Brian O'Connell spent several days north and south talking to people who remember only too well what life was like when a hard border was in place, and all were adamant that a hard border wouldn't be tolerated again, given the divisions and the tensions in their communities in the past. On Monday, Brian stopped off near the Monaghan border late one evening to meet up with 82-year-old farmer Pather Morgan.
You're overlooking part of Dynoose and Middletown. Thousands of bullets came over this hill here. My farm goes that way there, and the border goes actually through the middle of it. I have 20 acres in the north and 24 in the south. The British Army came one day in the 69-70 and cratered the whole road. Of course, we resented that, and I organised a group of men round here to fill in these craters, and that went on for... oh, God knows, a couple of years. The first ever landmines was set across the border there, not far from here. And there was a number of British Army personnel killed there.
Would you cross the border every day through your fields?
Oh, I do. Well, not through the fields. The road's open now because it showed the fire.
But I'm saying back in the day when the roads were blocked, you were still crossing the border through the fields, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I surely should. We had it.
So did it impact on your life that much?
Oh, it did, surely. Mm. Yeah. Well, you see, I'm reared on this border. I'm 82 years of age now. And I've lived on this border. I've seen all classes of smuggling of all shapes on this border. Where you can see that light crossing the border now. But there's a border road there, and it was severed there by the British Army. And, of course, there was about 30 or 40 of us filling in the holes. And the British Army attacked us with tear gas. And, God, I tell you, it wasn't nice. It wasn't pleasant, believe you me.
You do hear this narrative now that some people say, oh, there was never really a border.
Well, we wouldn't recognise any borders here. Especially the situation we're in, where you have a farm of land here and adjoining onto the next farm, which is in Northern Ireland.
Brian O'Connell reporting for Today with Sean O'Rourke on Monday. But I leave you now with the song from Picture This, who played live on The Ray D'Arcy Show ahead of 5 sold-out concerts in Dublin next month. Gurma gavaswar goluther, thasulam gurwan shiv salta saglar, agus gmeshiv lom taka anamakena, an tachtan chahugin, gajishin, gajishib slan.
Tell me your side so we can move on. Kissing my friends is always wrong, but I'm not too worried, 'cause we're still so young now. Ooh, yeah. And just like this night, we won't last long. So let's leave this party. I'll find my way home into your body. Leave the light on now. Ooh.